everyone. My name is Jalen, and on this episode for the Hotelli Podcast, we have Jess Sisko. Jess Sisko is the director of team coaching for the Cornell Johnson School of Management and the founder and managing partner of ActiveLeading.com LLC, an organization that provides consulting services to coach individuals and teams. After graduating with undergraduate and graduate degrees from Cornell, he remained loyal to his alma mater and held numerous roles across the university, including assistant restaurant manager, organizational development consultant, and senior human resources business partner. He also leads a very healthy lifestyle with his avid strength training and outdoor activities, such as wakeboarding and water skiing.
Welcome back to another episode of the Hotelli Podcast. I'm your host, Lucas Wero.
I'm your co-host, Teo Bielan, and today we are joined by our esteemed guest, Jess Sisko. Jess Sisko, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me, guys.
Of course. Yeah, thanks for joining us. So, first question, kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, what your connection to the hotel school is, to Cornell. Just give us a little background.
Sure. So, I have a lot of different relationships with Cornell, but first is I graduated from this wonderful institution, the Nolan School of Hotel Administration. And so, I'm a hotel school student. And I also serve in a few different roles as an employee at Cornell. Currently, I'm a visiting lecturer in the ILR school, and I teach a leadership course. 7,451 is the course number, really about self-awareness, emotional intelligence, and things like that to help students be most successful as professionals. I also did my MBA in the Johnson School, and so I have a lot of different connections to Cornell and a lot of love for this institution.
Amazing. So you started off your academic career in biology at Washington State University. What prompted this transition into the hospitality world? Because they are quite different.
Yeah, definitely very different. So I'm a first-generation student in my family. And when I went to school, I thought I needed to do what my parents and my grandparents wanted me to do. They envisioned that I'd be a great doctor or a lawyer or something in the medical field. And so I started studying biology, and I didn't quite know exactly what I wanted to do. I thought, well, I'll give it a try. So I took all these biology courses, chemistry courses. I took organic chemistry, biochemistry, and struggled through those courses and realized, I don't know that this is my calling. But while I was going to school, I worked in restaurants and in food service. So I worked at a grocery store, and I loved interacting with people. And I found that if I could brighten somebody's day, if I could make somebody laugh, if I could just be connected with others, I was really happy and I felt fulfilled in life. And when I happened to hear about and learn about the hotel school, and I happened to move across the country from the West Coast where I was going to school to the East Coast, I started going to school here and realized I finally found my place. There's a school on hospitality. There's a school about working with guests, and I loved the transition. It was a much better fit for me.
Did you ever explore opportunities when working in F&B?
Yes, definitely. So while I was going to school, when I transitioned as a normal undergrad during my biology time and I came here, I worked as a restaurant manager when I first started school. And so I worked in hospitality. I worked in management. And I did it for years, and I loved it. But as you might experience when you get out into the world as hospitality professionals, restaurant life is fast-paced. It's nights, it's weekends, it's holidays. And I really loved it when I was in my 20s. But as I got a little bit older, into my 30s, I wanted to do something different. And so I transitioned out of the restaurant industry and started doing other things like teaching.
So one of the things that, when I took your class, business writing, freshman year, everyone takes a class. One of the things that you told me, and someone who is your mentor, was Professor Snow. What was so inspiring about him that almost prompted you into getting into these teaching positions?
Great question. What was inspiring about him? I think I told you a little bit about me being really enthralled with talking with people and trying to brighten their day. I think what's inspiring about Professor Snow, at least one thing, is that he has those same feelings, but it's about students. It's about teaching and helping people to grow. And so when I was his student, I could just feel how much he wanted to invest in me and the other students in the class in a way that I didn't feel from other professors. And so you might remember stories that I would tell you in class, but I'll tell a brief story here. So when I was his student, he had many assignments like you had to do in our course, Business Writing for Hospitality Professionals. And after he'd assign every assignment, he often required that we would come and meet with him to debrief and learn from the assignment. He held about 30 hours of office hours every week. And so I'd never experienced a professor who met so frequently with students to give them verbal feedback and help them go through their writing and really improve. And so that was a way he invested in students, and he got a lot out of it. He got to meet with people. He got to see how they thought. He was inspired. He would get ideas. So I loved that part of his class. He also gave a lot of written feedback, and I could tell that it was really helpful. So those are a few things that inspired me, but he seemed like he gave back to students in a way that I'd never experienced before. So I wanted to do a little bit of what he did when I taught the course too.
That's amazing. And what's your perspective for students who want to find those mentors or and the importance of mentorship during your time at Cornell and even afterwards in the workforce?
That's a great question. I think all of us need people in our life who have done things that we haven't done or who have roles that we might be curious about, but we're not sure if we want to do the work to go into a particular industry. And so you can have formal mentors who you talk to and you interact with and ask if they will be your mentor, and you set up some sort of a relationship where you meet periodically. Or you can just have informal mentors. I consider Professor Snow still a mentor of mine, and I meet with him regularly, but it's not a formal mentor relationship. So in a way, you could consider him an informal mentor, but he's been a part of my life for decades now. And so I think having people that inspire you or who know things that you don't know and seem interested in you, like that can be kind of an informal mentor. Depending on what kind of a career you go into, you might work in an organization that actually has a formal program. And so like if you're going into the banking industry and you're an analyst, you might end up working at a bank that actually has a formal mentor program, and they might have the next level up and they might assign you to a mentor that you meet with and talk to. I think personally in my own career, people like Professor Snow or people like Dean Susskind, Professor Susskind at the hotel school, or the former general manager of the Statler Hotel, Rick Ady. These are all people who may or may not know until this comes out that I consider them mentors in my life because they have particular talents or skills and they seem to care about me. And those two ingredients, I think, are really important. Somebody who cares about you and wants to know you and help you, and somebody who knows something that you don't know or don't know as well and you want to learn from. So yeah, definitely get mentors, whether they know it or not.
Amazing. So Professor Snow teaches MBA students and a plethora of people that are way further in the industry than a lot of undergraduates. And I know yourself, you're also pretty involved with teaching some of these students. What do you think is the biggest challenge that these individuals face after they get out of undergraduate or are coming in from, you know, maybe a few years in the industry?
It's a tough question. So I think it probably depends on who the person is and what industry they went into. I think of a few examples of people who pop into my mind, I won't say their names necessarily so you can't identify them, but I think one example pops into my mind, a former student who graduated maybe 15 years ago. He went into investment banking, and I think the challenge for him is he probably enjoyed the career in some ways. He was making a really sustainable income. He was doing very well financially, and he was missing some of the things that he cared about that are more deep than that. Like, I'm not sure exactly how to categorize it, but he went to the hotel school, and so he cared a lot about food and beverage. And so this person that I'm thinking of ended up starting a few years before the pandemic. He started a coffee company, and so it was kind of his part-time passion project, but it was a real business, and it was functioning relatively well. And so he's one example. I'd love to tell you his name, but I don't know if he'd want to be mentioned. He's one example of a particular challenge. Like when you get out into the world, you need to make money and you need to live, but that's not necessarily enough to fulfill everybody. And so you have to figure out what are the other things that are maybe missing and how do you bring those things into your life? So I think that's one challenge. Another challenge is, I think when you're in school, you always have a new semester coming or a new quarter, depending on what your setup is in academics. And you're always taking new classes and being challenged in new ways. And so all of that's really exciting and challenging, obviously, when you have a lot of things you want to work on. But when you get out into the real world and you're in a professional setting, you start a job and you might get a little bit of training. And then once you're able to do that job, you might end up doing the same thing for multiple years before you get a promotion. And so another challenge that I think I've heard from hotel school students in particular, but probably any of us, depending on where you go to work, if you're not getting challenged or you feel like after a year or so, you kind of like, I think I know how to do this job. I'm ready for the next challenge. And if you don't have a supervisor who's supportive and challenging you or giving you growth or training, you can start to feel like you're stagnant. And I think when you're a young student and you've worked so hard and you've achieved and then you get into the real world and those opportunities of change don't occur so regularly, it can be really challenging. And so you might have some follow-up questions, but I'm sure some people might be wondering, well, what should I do if I'm in one of those scenarios? How do I handle it? But I'll pause there and let you ask the next question.
Oh, well, very insightful. We'd love to almost hear some more of the things that you have to say about that.
Sure. So what would you do if you're in the second scenario where you're out in the world, you've been doing well, you've been in a role for a year or two or three? Should you push for a new opportunity or should you start looking for a new job if you feel like you're stagnant? I think it depends. It always depends on the setting that you're in. But I think you can probably seek out opportunities for growth no matter what you end up doing. So say you go and work for a restaurant company or a hotel and you're in maybe a management program and you run a particular department, even though that's your role, you could start talking to your formal supervisor about, hey, what if I were to do, what if I spent some time shadowing another department to learn a little bit more about what they do and try to support them? Or if you're in a meeting with other managers in the restaurant or the hotel company and you hear about a new project or something that they're thinking about doing, you can raise your hand to try to volunteer for things. You can talk with your supervisor about what you're hoping to achieve in your career. You can ask if there are any problems that they're working on that maybe you could learn from. So you can, in some ways, you have to advocate for yourself. So that's a restaurant or hotel example. But no matter what industry you go into, the person who's going to care about your career the most is probably you. Sometimes you might have a really powerful supervisor who cares a lot about you. I've had some great supervisors in my past who advocated for me and who gave me opportunities for learning, but not everybody is like that. And so sometimes you have to find your own growth opportunities.
I love that. And so if we go back to that first story, I think that's very relevant to a lot of students, at least at the, I think at Cornell and a lot of universities in the world, is that it's really hard to find that work-life balance, right? You have all these extracurriculars that you can take part in, but it's almost like you have to compete for grades or clubs or extra or part school, pretty much. And so what do you say to students that are prioritizing school over their other extracurriculars when college is pretty much a time to find those things that you enjoy and those hobbies, because you have friends from everywhere that are interested in doing all sorts of things? I mean, one example for myself is I love going camping. I have a few friends that would go with me at any time of the day, but I almost don't do that because I have to do schoolwork.
So that question is tough, because when you're a student, your job is to be a student and you need to be successful. And so maybe the answer lies in where are you at on a scale of burnout? Like, are you starting to feel incredibly burned out and you're not performing your best? You're not thinking as clearly. You don't have as much focus or attention. You find your mind wandering. If you're like starting to feel pretty burned out, you might actually find that taking a break and going camping would actually recharge you and give you some of the motivation and clarity that you need to keep going. Or if you're not feeling particularly burned out and you're actually energized, like as you do your next thing, like maybe you start a Hotelli podcast and that's energizing to you, even though it takes up time and takes you away from some of your academic pursuits, that's fueling you and it's giving you energy to keep going, then maybe you don't need to go camping. Maybe camping will come in the summer or it'll come another time. And so it's not turning it on or off. It's when is what I'm doing helping me? And when do I need to maybe make a change? Like another thing that happens when you're a student is you maybe miss out on sleep, or if you get really busy. I care a lot about health. And so when I was a student, I used to work out a lot. But when I noticed when I'd get really busy or like a test was coming up and I just felt like I needed to study extra or I had a bigger project, the things that I would sacrifice are my sleep and my exercise. And if I were to do that for weeks on end, if I stopped the habits that give me energy and keep me focused, that could be a problem. And so what choices could I be making differently so I could do the things that give me energy and help me remain clear and keep me healthy? So in the long term, those habits are really important. In the short term, sometimes you can make choices to sacrifice the things that you need to do. But hopefully in the long term, you find some other choices so you can keep doing the things that fuel you.
And you already mentioned it, but you're very passionate about, you know, self-development and how that intersects with health and wellness. So my question for you is, what are some of the habits that you practice regularly now as a professor? And I know you have your own consulting business, which I'll want to get to in a little bit. But what are some of the practices that you kind of do right now to make sure that you have that balance?
Great question. I definitely prioritize my health. I've always done it since I was young. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to either of you two, but clearly not to your listeners. When I was 11 years old, I remember I was particularly skinny and I used to get teased a lot. And so I went to the library and checked out books on bodybuilding. And so I started to learn at a really young age how to train for strength and for changing my physical look. And so I used to train for different reasons, but that kind of gave me a base of knowledge when I was really young. And so now, and it's changed throughout my life, but I think physical fitness is really important to me. It gives me energy. It helps me to perform and think better. And it allows me to do the things that I like to do in life. We can talk about extracurriculars if you'd like at some point. But the things that I find are really important for my health are regularly, 3 days a week at least, but it's 3 or 4 or 5 days a week, I do some strength training. And it's looked different throughout my life. I used to train kind of like a bodybuilder. And so I do particular exercises on particular days for a lot of sets. And then there was a few years where I did CrossFit or kind of functional fitness type activities, HIIT trainings and things like that. And now I train mostly just for strength. And so I do different things for different reasons, but I do have some sort of strength training. And I have some other things that I do, like I'll walk or run a few times a week just for different types of movement. And so that's kind of my physical fitness. But all of that helps me to prepare for the sports that I like to do. Like I went snowboarding a couple weeks ago to Gore Mountain. And as long as I take care of my body physically, I can do that sport really well. And I went on Sunday, I went to a ninja gym. I don't know if you've ever watched American Ninja Warrior. But because of my strength training, I was actually able to do some of the things I've seen on TV, and I never knew if I could do it, but it turns out I can. The salmon ladder, where you have a bar and you jump up just with your arm strength, rungs.
Very impressive.
I went all the way up the salmon ladder and back down it, and basically the first time I tried it. And so doing that kind of stuff is really important, but it's another form of play, but my physical training helps.
So one of the interesting things that I remember from your class is, so you spend a lot of time here in the summer. It's probably one of the beautiful times to be here. And you're an avid kind of boat goer. I remember seeing videos and pictures of you wakeboarding and things like that. And those are probably one of my favorite sports. I don't know if you can really call it a sport. Some people might say yes, some no. But I personally am a slalom skier. I love that. The rooster tail, jumping the wake, getting around those buoys. Love those types of things. And I feel like everyone should try that at some point. Would you like to just tell us a little bit about your experience getting into that and why you keep doing it?
Great question. And it reminds me, I just started thinking about this because we may actually offer a PE course here at Cornell in the fall that'll be wakeboarding and wake surfing on one of my boats. I'm working on my captain's license right now. And so I may be able to teach something I've enjoyed for years. So when I was thinking about this PE course, I started to think about I first started water skiing. And I think it was when I was 12 or 13 years old. One of my best friends, he's still a part of my life, his name's Josh. Josh's family is part of this, they have some history in Priest Lake, like a religious leader, priest, in Idaho. And when I was 13 or so, he took me with his family for one of their summer excursions to Priest Lake. It was like, I don't know, an 8 or 9 hour drive to go there. And it's a beautiful mountain lake. It's probably fed by like glaciers and melt and things like that. So it's this pristine, like super clear lake. It was so clean and clear that the cabin that they lived in had a pipe that went down into the lake, and they would pull water from the lake directly, and you could drink it without getting sick. I don't know if you still could. I assure you, I did not get sick while visiting. But one of those trips, I learned how to water ski, and I loved it so much. I was thinking, like, how could they have let me do this? The lake is a pretty big lake. It's maybe 30 or so miles long and, I don't know, 8-10 miles wide. And one time we were driving to the north, well, boating to the north side of the lake, and I'd been water skiing and I really liked it. And I asked Josh's dad, could I water ski as we drive up there? It's like 20 miles. And he's like, if you think you can hang on that long. And so I water skied all the way to the north end of the lake. So it just gives you a sense of me really enjoying it. And I think when I was a little bit older, maybe like 16 or 17, I tried wakeboarding. And I really liked that too. And then I switched to doing snowboarding. And I used to ski, snow ski, but I also started snowboarding. So I think when I switched over from skiing to snowboarding, I also switched over from water skiing to wakeboarding. And they're similar but different, different stance and different kind of things that you do. Like you mentioned slalom skiing, you're leaned way over and it takes lots of forearm strength and you're like working your shoulders really hard. When you're wakeboarding, you're more maybe interested in doing jumps and tricks and things like that. So I like the feeling of getting into the air. So I love jumps.
Amazing. So do you also train in the terrain parks when you go snowboarding?
Yes, I do.
Oh, wow. Good for you. I don't know if I can say I enjoy those as much.
I've hurt myself a few times in the terrain park. I broke my clavicle, and I've broken my wrist before on a rail. So I still do it, but train parks are more dangerous, obviously.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, please let us know if that PE course comes to fruition. I would love to sign up for that. I kind of want to go back to what I was mentioning earlier about your consulting work.
Sure.
And I know that's a big part of you, and so I was just wondering if you could tell a little bit about what that experience kind of is like, and with the type of companies that you work for, maybe some of the struggles that the companies face that you see in general. So just a little bit of background about that.
Sure. So consulting work is really interesting because you get to solve different problems. Obviously, whatever your niche is or whatever your industry of expertise is or the types of problems you might work in, but each client, even if it's in the same industry, has a different problem. So a couple of examples. When I first started consulting, one of the biggest clients that I worked with a partner, her name's Barbara. Barbara and I worked for a bank, a worldwide bank, but we worked for their New York City arm. And again, I won't use names to protect their identity. But this banking client wanted to develop basically a leadership soft skills program for their interns and their new hires. They wanted to help them be better as their young professionals just getting into the workforce. What does it take to be successful? And so one of the things that you do when you're a consultant is you listen to the client and try to understand what is their problem, what are they trying to solve, and ask a bunch of questions to make sure that you understand what it is that they need, and then you develop a solution. And our solution was, depending on whether it was interns or new hires, we had a couple of hour program for maybe interns, And then we'd have a half day or a full day workshop of a bunch of different activities that we put people through so that they could learn more about themselves, self-awareness. They could learn different skills that we thought were helpful. And so we used an emotional intelligence model. So we focused on things like self-awareness, feedback, things like that, and resilience, self-management, which is like, how do I regulate my emotions when I'm under extreme stress at work, and helping them to understand those kind of things. How do I communicate with different people who have different cultural backgrounds? So that was one particular client. We developed these workshops that met their needs, and we got to do that for a few years together. It was a lot of fun. But that's one client. I have many other examples I could give you.
Amazing. So as a consulting and kind of seeing different sides of the industry and different companies, what do you think about communication? Do you think people can work on it? I mean, as a business mindset, as someone who is teaching business writing and has pretty much taught me and Teo how effective good communication can be, how do you think companies could adopt some of the things that you teach?
That's a great question. So you mentioned my mentor, Professor Snow, and Professor Snow has many big business clients that you might know from the Dow Jones or S&P 500. Again, we'll keep their names private. But he is out there doing exactly what you're talking about, helping them to communicate more clearly, either in writing through memos or reports, different formats of written communication, or verbally, depending on what the client needs. And so I think the principles that we teach in our business writing course apply really well to business. And just, again, if we think of Professor Snow as an example, some of the people that come to him are former students who know what you two know. And those students wish that others in their current organization, wherever they end up working, could communicate like we communicate. And so those students reach out to Professor Snow, and he will come in and he will provide a half day or a full day or a multi-day workshop to try to help help working professionals to learn some of these principles. So I believe that, yes, all of us can be better communicators in writing or verbally. And a few things that can be helpful are if you learn what influences the communication that we have. So in our course, you might remember the highest level virtue of communication is being clear. And we have a few ways to be clear. I could go into it, but I don't know that we have the time for that. So just know that our highest level virtue of communication is being clear. People can understand us. That's what we're hoping for.
That's awesome. And can you give us a top career lesson that you learned along your journey throughout your professional working experience that you wish you would have known when you were a student here at Cornell?
So one of the things that I focus on a lot and think about a lot in my own life is feedback. And so I think when you're a student, you get a lot of feedback in your courses. You get an academic grade for your deliverables. And so you're getting evaluation a lot. But when you get into the workforce, you don't have as much concrete, depending on where you go and what you do, you might not have grades as a measure of feedback. And so I think I wish I would have known how important feedback was, and I wish I would have known what my response was to feedback when I was younger. So when I was young, I didn't realize it, but I would get kind of defensive, and my defensive mechanism was to blame other people or try to shift, well, this is the reason why that happened, or here's why it wasn't my fault. And what I was doing, I fortunately had a supervisor point it out to me. His name's Arnie. And Arnie told me, Jess, I've noticed when I give you feedback, you usually have an excuse or a reason why it wasn't your fault. I don't care whose fault it was. I just need you to learn and say it won't happen again. That's all I need. And it was kind of like a revelation to me. It really did start to flip a switch. I didn't need to defend myself. Nothing was wrong with me. I just needed to hear what he was saying and make an adjustment. And so I wish that I could have been better at that earlier in my life. And I've worked really hard to be a much better feedback receiver and to deliver feedback in a way where people can hear it so they don't get defensive, even though I can't control their responses. So my advice would be learn how to find the lessons in feedback. And if you want a resource, there's a Harvard Business Review article called How to Find the Coaching in Criticism. If you Google that, HBR, find the coaching in criticism, you get a few tips.
Incredible. I think that's something that almost all of us can learn from, something definitely I could definitely learn from. So thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today. It's been a pleasure. It was great having you as a teacher, as a professor, and it was great speaking with you today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been another episode of the Hotelli Podcast, and we thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you guys next time. Thank you.